Casey, what right do you have to break taboo?
I have the right to break taboo. I mean, anyone has the right to break taboo, but I feel I'm entitled to breaking taboo because of my own sexual orientation and also bringing that orientation to the University of Montana in 94 and working on exploring that taboo and expanding its limits for students and faculty and the community.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, talking with Casey Charles about The Monkey Cages. This program contains content of a sexual nature for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. Don't go away. I want to circle around to your career in a broader sense, but I want to just jump into the context of your novel. At its heart, it's a love story between a teenage narrator, Tommy Cadigan, and his high school's football coach during the time of the 1955 Boise, Idaho homosexuality scandal. Can you briefly describe to our listeners the scandal itself and how it came to you as a catalyst for the book?
Sure, yes. I have been teaching, you know, gay and lesbian studies since I got here, pretty much. And in the process, I ran into a book called The Boys of Boise, which was written by John Girasi in the 60s sometime. And so that book kind of turned me on to the story. And as I continued to publish and write about law and literature, because I'm also a lawyer, and trials in particular, I thought about this case, this historical event, which involved a lot of trials, a lot of people were put away for life as well as a result of this scandal, as a really good backdrop for a love story that broke taboos around generational stuff, around education, around orientation, religion, all kinds of things.
And this type of criminalization and pathologizing of gays and lesbians was in conjunction with the McCarthy era. And the book makes reference to the Pink Scare. Can you briefly describe some of the atrocities of the era in regards to the mistreatment? I mean, you've referenced, you know, that they might have been put away for life, but what else?
Well, in Washington, during the Eisenhower years, in conjunction with McCarthyism, there was a so-called pink or lavender scare in which homosexuals were thought to be subversive and, by some stretch of the imagination, therefore communist. And there were some federal orders that led to the dismissal of a number of employees, like 3,000 or something. And then across the country, there were all kinds of similar events to the one in Boise, in Florida, for example. So there was a lot of anti-gay, though the word gay didn't really exist back then, activities going on in the federal level and the state level as well.
And coming back to your book,
yeah.
The book is erotically charged.
Thank you.
Yeah. What is your response to readers who grapple with, you know, the generational love story or the intergenerational love story and the graphic visual content
of the book?
Yeah.
Well, I think that it is a kind of taboo to think about talking about sex, especially when you're talking about sex between a 16-year-old and a 24 or 5-year-old who's supposed to, you know better, supposedly. But on the other hand, it was a kind of mutual love story. So it's not Lolita to some extent, right?
Right.
And I wanted to somehow cross that border and think about the sexual imagination of teenagers as well as adults and to explore it. That's why I kind of made the main character, Tommy, into really the one that goes after Coach and seduces him. And then also I had to, you know, deal with trying to write about a sex scene with a teenager, which was quite difficult, but I didn't see how I could get around that.
Right.
Yeah. At the Cherry Mill Motel or wherever it was. Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah.
And in an interview with a Missoulian, you said, we don't want teenagers to vote. We don't want them to drink. We don't want them to have sex. We want to put them in little cages and treat them like innocent pets. And they aren't. They're smart and articulate and manipulative human beings in ways we don't allow teenagers to be. I want to know, first of all, how do you wish you had been treated differently when you were a teenager?
Well, that's a really excellent question. I think I also grew up and maybe in more in the 50s and the 60s more, but very kind of guarded, unsexualized life, except to the degree that it was kind of Life magazine heterosexual, kind of like Romeo and Juliet, Zeffirelli's, right? We still watch that. And that becomes the kind of default for the way you can be sexual in the world. You know, be romantic, get married, have kids, right? So it would have been really, I think, amazing to be able to open up to other kinds of possibilities of sexuality when kids now are because of, you know, the net and stuff like that and the web. So on the one hand, I'm a real Puritan and I really believe in the kind of sacredness of not being tortured by sexual desire when you're a child. But on the other hand, I think that it's really important that we give kids an opportunity to explore their feelings. So I feel a little strangely, I don't know, you know, it's very hard to put myself back into that period and to think about it.
I notice you just dropped a Shakespeare reference and you're a professor of Shakespeare. So I guess I want to ask you, you know, if it weren't the Romeo and Juliet story, what Shakespeare story would you have rather found yourself in?
Well, I've, you know, done work on Twelfth Night, which I think has all the different kinds of sexuality in it, even though it's a comedy. It's Shakespeare's comedies are as serious as the tragedies, some say. So, and there's same-sex desire in, and actually same-sex desire between an older Antonio, a pirate, and the younger Sebastian. So that would kind of opened up the possibility, right, mm-hmm. to be exposed to something like that, to be exposed to the possibility that Hamlet and Horatio actually had more going on than just being, you know, students at Wittenberg, right? And there's a lot of language that kind of opens you up to, even if they didn't do anything, to the kind of romantic closeness that they had. And so, you know, that's, I think, really important for teenagers to be able to understand the possibilities around intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Thinking about intimacy and love, one of the other statements you made in this interview, that you wanted to challenge who's entitled to tap into the joys of love. Mm-hmm. And when I read that, I was really struck by it, and I wanted to know about your personal connection to either the feeling of limitations or limitlessness around love.
Well, I think my experience personally was having to overcome a lot of cultural and social expectations. Even though I grew up in the Bay Area, I came from a Catholic family, and the odd thing is, and my first novel is about this, of how ironic it is for someone from the San Francisco Bay Area to come out in the land of the Castro. I felt that to really come to your own feelings about intimacy, you have to let go of some of the social and cultural expectations. And I'm not quite sure how to do that, but that's, I think, the most important thing is to kind of stretch your imagination and allow yourself to feel things without the kind of conventions that keep us from getting in touch with our own imaginations.
Is there a love story connected to your arrival in Montana? Whether it be love of place or study or person?
That's comparable to this, to the novel?
Not necessarily, but just in your life.
Well, there is. I mean, I I'm writing about it right now, actually, because I'm doing a memoir about, I've been HIV positive since the 90s. And I actually acquired HIV in a deeply romantic situation. So it was this strange irony, as it were, where you actually contract a deadly virus, which it was then, as a result of this amazing intimacy that I'd never had before. was kind of the most, it was my first amazing gay relationship, which led to my partner's finding out that he was HIV positive when he went to get his green card. And I'm writing about that right now. So yeah, it's very difficult to do.
I mean, in that I hear the limitations and the limitlessness, sort of how love opens you up and also can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, and of course I've always been, I think, pretty much a romantic.
Yeah.
You know, when I was going to Santa Cruz and stuff, I was like reading the romantic poets and I did have a kind of a heterosexual romantic imagination. And what I really think that this book hopefully will do will not just explore sexuality, but explore the idea of romance outside of gender.
Yes.
You know, and that involves letter writing. It involves imagination. It involves, you know, desire. It doesn't always involve action, right?
Yes.
And to open up that space is just really what I'm hoping to do.
And that space is inhabited by another type of love, which is between Tommy and his best friend,
yes.
Freddie, who is this like Mormon intellectual. And why did you want to highlight that relationship?
Because I think when we're in high school, as I presume you did too, you always kind of glom on or you find a couple of really close friends that are just kind of become, you know, your daily touch base. And so Freddie and Tommy became that kind of really close-knit two guys that just shared everything. You know, they have this whole pact where they have to tell the truth, everything but the truth, right? And mm-hmm. so when Tommy finds out about Freddie's father, he's tortured about, the first half of the book is he's tortured about whether or not to disclose that.
Do you want to say more about that?
Well, on the one hand, you know, you become your best friend or even your husband or your wife, there are no secrets between you, right?
Right.
But then you find out a secret that may hurt the other.
Right.
And as you were talking earlier about intimacy, and I think that's really kind of a crucial way of thinking about the book, is like, you know, when the truth hurts, when do you disclose it? And does that bond that you have transcend the possibility of breaking the bond by disclosing the truth?
What was it like to inhabit Tommy's voice?
Well, it was hard because it was third person. The book originally, I was looking back and sarcastically looking back at that time of my life.
Yeah.
And being able to be more jokey and ironic. But then when I was challenged to put it in the first person, I had to really restrain myself because Tommy's smart and a smart aleck and sarcastic like most teenagers. Yeah. But he's also, you know, he's a kid. So you have to kind of get yourself into that mindset where he's kind of silly. He kind of does stupid things. He follows the coach around the gym and stuff like that. So he's kind of a combination of, you know, he's somewhat unrealistic because he is so intelligent, but he's also got this kind of goofy, try anything kind of side. And I've taught some Shakespeare to kids at Big Sky and other high schools, and it's amazing how energetic they can be around putting on scenes. I mean, they don't have as much taboo or restrictions, conventional restrictions that college kids do. And mm-hmm. so some of that, I could get into some of that with Tommy.
Yes.
Right? And also the idealism of Freddie comes out there too. And he's a character that also fits into the gay genre a little bit.
I want to talk about that because I looked at the back of your book and it says gay fiction.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, you know, what are the... maybe how is that helpful as a designation and how is that irrelevant?
Well, it's a really good question right now, thinking about the way we pigeonhole different genres and types of literature and how that keeps our readers from approaching the book or how it gets them into a whole new world at the same time. So it's kind of a double-edged sword, like intimacy, as we just talked about. But there are certain conventions about with gay writing, starting with, you know, Edmund White's Boy's Own Story, Giovanni's Room, James Baldwin's book, where they usually end in people drowning or killing themselves or, you know, these kind of tragic stories of, or it could be more of a funny story like Ruby Fruit Jungle is more of a picaresque. famous book of the 50s about a lesbian. So anyway, I think that I'm kind of buying into that genre.
Yeah.
But I'm also trying to establish the book as a book about the West,
mm-hmm.
and a book about having same-sex desire in our particular Rocky Mountain community, even though it's the 1950s. You know, so there's a whole kind of overlay of that culture onto same-sex desire in a kind of semi, you know, it's not, obviously not Brokeback Mountain, which is an amazing short story and film, but some of that is in there.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Casey Charles about his novel, The Monkey Cages. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. As a reminder, this program contains content for a mature audience. Listener discretion is advised. I want to pivot to some of the darker elements. In regards to trauma, you reference post-traumatic stress disorder as it relates to veterans of war, but you also, in the interview, talk about the trauma of living in the closet. Can mm-hmm. you say more about that?
Well, I think, especially in the 50s, we had a number of the people that left town when this whole scandal broke out. And I'm used to some of the characters, like the guy that owned the hamburger joint, Howdy Partner. He, according to Gerasi, found the headlines in the Statesman, and he left his family that morning. He did not finish his breakfast. And he was a married man and with kids, with Trent as his character in the book.
Mm-hmm.
He just got up and left.
Wow.
And there were a number of those people that just, you know, were got scared and just left. And they were, you know, they were men who had sex with men, as we call them now, right?
Right.
And but the taboo against that was so fantastic. It still is here in Montana, I think, but not as great as it was in the 50s. So, you know, there is a trauma of living in the closet. And it's around secrecy and around not being truthful to yourself and also probably to your friends as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Getting back to the point that you brought up earlier about intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to hurt your wife, or you don't want to hurt your straight friends by telling them that you're gay, right? But you want to be truthful. So, and that, I think you're right. I think that can create a kind of tension that traditionally over the years has led to, you know, all kinds of self-destructive behaviors by gays and lesbians in terms of suicide, in terms of just abuse of alcohol and that kind of stuff, and other drugs and things like that. You know, it can be very traumatic that way.
One of the things that struck me about the book is that Tommy has these overwhelming crying spells, and he calls it emotional incontinence and says, "I'm borderline PBA, almost diagnosed with pseudobulbar effect." How did you come across this diagnosis, and why attribute it to Tommy?
Well, that's a really good question, because I found that he, I had to make Tommy into, just as I had to make Coach into somebody who'd had PTSD and reparative therapy and electroshock shock in order to allow him to be a little bit off the wall. With Tommy, you know, he has to be extremely passionate. And now the disease that he has is actually, you know, on the spectrum of not epilepsy, but something like it, if it at its extreme,
like a seizure, sort
like
of
a
disorder.
Seizure thing at its extreme. But in his kind, on the spectrum, on his spectrum, it's just that he's able to emote. I wanted to use it to show that he's able to kind of show his feelings easily and does so,
yeah.
As a way to kind of back up the kind of crush that he has.
The on passion.
The passion, exactly, exactly, right.
When I was digging into the book, I was looking and listening for all these little inferences, right? You have Tommy considers his own Private Idaho story. There's a play in the book, Tea and Sympathy. And I'm just wondering about your embedding these references, both as cultural touchstones and also as like little winks to the reader that you know, that I know, that we know, that
yeah.
there's this context.
Yeah.
What can you say about that?
Well, there are a lot of references in the book. There's references to the music of the period. And a lot of the music of the period is about making love to teenagers that were, you know, top of the charts, Chuck Berry, Sweet Little 16. So I wanted to kind of use that culture or these cultural references to kind of tap into the fact that under the Victorian veneer of the 50s, there was a whole world of innuendo and Mel Dear kind of theater people who were part and parcel of a kind of semi-gay culture, right? And also the whole references to things like My Own Private Idaho, et cetera, are, you know, part and parcel of the kind of insider jokes that are associated with being gay. You know, with just tapping into the gay culture icons, you know.
I want to move into the legal element of the book because you're also a lawyer.
Right. I'm licensed to practice in California, yeah.
And you teach Shakespeare and, you know, queer literature and studies. How do you live with this integrated sense of self and discipline?
Well, sometimes I wish I had just come and, you know, spent 25 years studying Milton, which I could have done when I got here. But the department was open enough that I was able to kind of move in directions that I wanted to move into. And the law also is a jealous mistress. She followed me around whenever I went on a job interview. It was, you know, why does a lawyer want to be an English teacher, right? Instead of the other way around, mm-hmm. which is a usual case. English teachers become lawyers to make money. Mm-hmm. And so I eventually figured out that I really had to talk about, you know, trials in Shakespeare. I really had to talk about The Merchant of Venice and Measure for Measure and things like that. So they really wanted me to integrate. And so I got interested in trials. And then also, as my queer life kind of blossomed here and I got into a relationship and I started teaching gay and lesbian stuff, I kind of mixed those two together. And as a result, most of my work is around this very strange little niche of queers in the law, which is not such a strange niche when you start exploring it. So and that led to the two novels I read and, you know, less so in the poetry, but a little bit in the poetry as well. Mm-hmm. So
I have next to me your book of poems, Zicatela, and it notes that you began writing poetry in Spanish while teaching in Mexico. Why do you think that was the natural turn for you?
Well, I think that the Romance languages lend themselves to poetry in ways that the Germanic ones, the Anglo-Saxon ones, don't necessarily. So being immersed in Mexico, teaching in Guanajuato, I just kind of got into the sound of words, and that led me to poetry.
And in this book, you reference Kenya. Mm-hmm. What was your experience there? And I'm wondering if you'll also read a poem from that part of your life.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, I went over to a literary seminar in Nairobi many years ago, 2011, I believe. And it took us to Africa and to Kenya, which is an amazing place. And Kenya itself is an incredibly beautiful country. And the Kenyans themselves are this amazing mix of colonial and tribal culture that creates a level of erudition and at the same time kind of, I won't say joie de vivre, which is kind of amazing.
Yes.
I mean, I don't
know. It's intoxicating.
It is intoxicating. So not just the landscape, which is also intoxicating, but also the people and the sky and everything. So, I went there and I worked on some poems. And I was also able to visit Korogocho, which is one of the slums, because I wanted to go to an HIV support group when I was there. I thought, oh, my God, because, you know, Kenya has the maybe fourth or fifth highest percentage of HIV positive people per capita in the world. So I was, I got in touch with a group, TICA, the Trust for Indigenous Culture and Health, and they took me to one of their support groups in the slums. And I also started questioning people a little bit about gay culture there, which is completely taboo.
Yes.
And that gave rise to the poem shoga, which is a kind of slang word for gay, whereas the more traditional Swahili word is masenge. And so I was at the conference, and everyone was talking about books and stuff like that. And, you know, there were some writers there, and it was a kind of a liberal group. And so I took the liberty of asking them about gay culture, or maybe that kind of a Western presumption on my part. But nonetheless, that gave rise to shoga. The name they use for men like me in Swahili. From the West, I bring this thing, un-African. At the forum, I ask about their laws. 14 years for touch. What about Uganda, the new death bill, their neighbor nation? What about those two men married in London, Kenyans cursed in Nairobi? Bishops and hip-hoppers united, a kill queer coalition. They check watches, cross their legs. No more time for questions. I squirm in my chair, turn red, bite my pen. They say, in Kenya, there are many phobias, even dreadlocks. They say, we believe in democracy, majority rule. What right have I to break taboo? Mzungu, foreigner, how dare I raise my hand a stone's throw from the slum? This silencer in me, tourist from Montana, from a state blood red, jawbreakers. Of course it exists, Billy tells me later. Late at night, at clubs, you find them, at the gypsy. Go to the big hotelie, go to the bar and drink. Check websites for safaris. In beach towns, he whispers, it's more relaxed. An undercurrent on the coast.
So of course my first question to you is from that poem. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking maybe my last question would be, if you were to give permission to our listeners for love, what kind of permission would you give them this Valentine's Day?
Well, I would say you need to take risks about how you feel about people and overcome, be ready to be hurt, but be ready to speak what you feel and say what you feel about others in ways that may get you into trouble or they may end up changing your life. That would be my advice. I mean, a lot of it is about overcoming inhibition for someone that you feel strongly about, even if you already know them. You know, life is short. You need to touch, you need to find that and express it, you know, in the true idea of expressing, right? Pressing out of yourself into making an impression on another, right? I don't know. I mean, that's, yeah. You know, love is tough, but it's so important. It's about survival. I will survive.
Casey Charles lives in Missoula, Montana, where he teaches Renaissance literature, queer studies, and critical legal studies. Look for more information about him and his work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and visit our Facebook page. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008. And thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer and production assistant. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis.